I'll use an illustration to show you what most contemporary theologians think about sin. Suppose when my daughter was about 2 years old, she would have spilled some milk on our best linen tablecloth. She did in fact do that. If I would have picked her out of the chair and started batting her around for having molested flesh, and malicious forethought, you know, just did it intentionally, erect a tablecloth. Any other human being there would have tied my arms behind my back and taken me away. Now, my daughter cried because she sensed something happened there that shouldn't have happened. But I picked her up and consoled her, because I knew that she didn't spill the milk intentionally. Her reflexes. And what is it? What are words you use?
Coordination,
yeah, and stuff. At 2 years old was the cause of the whole thing. She just imagined that I would be angry with her for this. In much the same way, that's the way people talk about sin now. We, listen to this. Remember now about this ultra-harmonization? Human race is on the way to some kind of perfection. We feel that future beckoning. We realize we haven't attained it. We interpret that as a moral fault on our part, a failure because of which God is angry. All we've got to be reassured is that at this stage of our development, God accepts us just like we are. You can read Paul Tillich's Shaking the Foundation, for instance, sermons where it sounds like Walter. Accept that you're accepted. The only thing different is Walter would say, for Christ's sake. And the point is this, that if you can persuade yourself that God will accept you just like you are, because he knows, remembers your dust, and at this stage of your development you're not capable of anything else, then you'll find it easier to accept other people with their limitations too, and then also some of the risks that we find in society will be healed. Let me just tell you, for instance, Volkman says, sin is a failure to break with the past and be open to the future. Faith is being open to the future. Tillich believed that there was such a thing as a human. Tillich was an existentialist. An existentialist with an existentialistic concern. He was really an existentialist. He believed, as existentialists do not, that there is such a thing as a human nature. The existentialists are necessary process philosophers or theologians who do not believe that there is such a thing as an abiding human nature. Otherwise, they couldn't talk about human nature as we know it now being transcended by something else later. But Tillich did believe that there was a human nature made up of a complex set of polar factors, only one of which I'm going to mention. It's like a teeter-totter. There's a dash of destiny in my being. I was not free to become swivel chair or a chandelier or a stomach pump. I was destined to be human. So there's that much destiny. However, being human, there's another factor, constituent factor of my being, which seems diametrically opposed to this, and that's freedom. How can you have destiny and freedom combined? Now, existentialists talk a great deal about freedom. In fact, that freedom and making choices is what they consider the human differentia, not the thing, you know, or stuff, but that we make decisions in freedom. All right, now, God is the grounded being that cannot be exhausted in any number of infinite other beings. Horses and trees and so on, they subsist wholly within the ground of the being. You never see a horse acting any way but horsey. or a dog, anyway, a dog, or a pig, anyway, the piggies. But you see, human beings act as piggies. However, now, but further, so dogs, trees, horses, they can subsist entirely within the ground of their being with no ontological estrangement. But for man to be a man, he had to stand out from the ground of his being in a different relationship from that in which trees and dogs and horses stand by, in order not to be in common, so he could exercise his freedom. This is what they call existence. When these men use the term existence, they don't merely mean present, a thing is here. Ex hyphen, distress. A man exists, he stands out from the ground of his being. He had to have the umbilical cord cut. There had to be this estrangement. Now, not many hospitals, but this estrangement from the ground of his being for him to be free. He was destined to be a man, but he's also free. Well, when this embryonic human being intuited his freedom, he at the same time intuited several other things. He intuited his responsibility. That's a necessary concomitant of freedom. You make choices in freedom, you're responsible. And he intuited also another thing, his finitude. Now, I would not mind being free if I were infinite. Existentialists talk about being doomed to be free. Freedom is a terrible burden. See, there are so many things that influence me. Heredity, environment, even demonic forces. And still I answer. Well, when this embryonic human being intuited his freedom, responsibility, and infinitude, he got nervous. He got a case of Urhunt. And feeling uneasiness. The fright is different from this. If I'm walking through a bush and a bear jumps out from behind a tree and I scamper up the closest tree around and get frightened, that's a normal, healthy reaction to a known threat. There's nothing sick about fear. But anxiety is another thing. It's an uneasiness. When things are going good, you wonder why. Like a guy went to a psychiatrist for a couple of years. He was being treated for a case of anxiety. Finally, the psychiatrist thought he was well enough to go on a little holiday or vacation. So he went away. 2 days later, the psychiatrist got a postcard from him, having a grand time. Why? Anxiety is a dis-ease. And remove the hyphen and it's a disease. And when it gets bad enough, you have to get help. Well, this original human being felt that uneasiness, stress. And to try to get rid of it, he did one or two things, which were not actually revolt against God. It wasn't something like committing adultery, murdering his neighbor. He emphasized this factor of his essence, his destiny, and said, "What am I nervous about? I'm destined, wholly destined. Nobody can hold me responsible for what I'm doing. A destined being can't act any other way than he's destined to act. And so I'm not. So I'm not. I can't be responsible." Or else, he did like take the senseless to it, afraid of the freedom and to set us free. And if freedom has any meaning at all, it means that I do what I want and I answer to nobody. Now, Tilly teaches that Christ came into the world not to die for us, not to do anything in our stead, not even to show us how to do something, but to show us it can be done. Christ was willing to assume human nature so that he could stand out from the ground of his being, to show us that you can, under the conditions of existence, keep the teeter-totter in perfect balance. You do need not make either this, the shape, or that. And as soon as you learn to keep the teeter-totter in balance, then you have attained new being, according to Tilly. Sin, then, is his definition of it, when your existence falls short of your essence. In other words, when you don't stand out from God the way you should.
By keeping the
core element of your being in perfect balance.
He attaches no moral or ethical meaning to sin at all, and doesn't take seriously anything the scriptures say about God's wrath or the atonement and things like that. It goes hand in hand, of course, why therefore they have to deny Christ's virgin birth and deity. If Christ came to demonstrate something that is a possibility for me to attain the new being, then he must have been a human being just like me, born of lowly parents, the Virgin Mary, and maybe a mercenary German soldier, not the Holy Ghost. And he could not have had benefit of communicated divine attributes, because I'm afraid what was a possibility for him isn't for me. I don't have communicated divine attributes. In principle, these people have to deny both the virgin birth and the deity of Christ. He had to be a human being. And I could read to you, I just read it to my last class, Theology of Lutheran Confessions, a document which came out of Lacusa about 7-8 years ago, called Who Can This Be? A Study in Christology, which says, perhaps we should not ascribe to Christ any capacity to conform to the Father's will that we do not have. And then a few sentences later says, his divinity lay not in his genealogy, but in his compassion. So this is a theology when I'm talking about this kind of theology, I'm not talking about something that is so far removed from us that you never encounter it. This is within Lacusa, the Lutheran Church of America, the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church was very Synod. Well, what are the consequences of the sin in terms of behavior? In Adam and Eve, it was disobedience to God. In us and all men, it is also disobedience toward God, but it also affects our relationship to our neighbor. When you read those passages, you'll find that Luther says that everybody wants to sit at the head table. Nobody wants anybody else to have more than he has. And if you think you're exempt from this, someday when you have a guest preacher, maybe for a mission festival or something, and for 3 Sundays afterwards you have to hear people tell you what a marvelous sermon he had. And then you start looking at what's going on in your own heart. First thing you say is, what's wrong with mine? It's sickening. It's just sickening. And we adorn it all with fancy names, as Luther says. Outright niggardliness, dishonesty, or whatever it may be, we adorn it with the name thrift. But God's not going to be fooled by that. Because he knows sin for what it is, and it incurs divine judgment. That's the wrath of God in the Lutheran symbols and in the scriptures. It's a terrible thing. That's not symbolic language. That means wrath. Punitive, divine, holy wrath that will utterly consume and destroy people who will not find life the only way he'll give it to them, and that is through faith in his Son. There will be temporal and eternal punishment for sin. Really, you can't know this corruption except by revelation. Luther says that expressly in the outline that I gave you for Small Called Articles. It is so deep, terrible a thing that it cannot be known by human reason, but only by revelation. God has to open your eyes to see it. You won't believe it. This is why it's good to look into the law. Till you see yourself for what you are. And let it make you sick. Now, Kierkegaard, poor Kierkegaard, all he ever did was got sick about it. It seems like he never knew about the forgiveness. And he was a pathetic figure. But I get sick every day when I think what a mess I am, when I see how this sin in me has twisted everything. But I still also daily rejoice, and the more for it, that God has infinite forgiveness, and that what St. Paul said is true: where sin abounds, grace doth much more abound. There's grace to cover that terrible sickness that should make us all ashamed. Now, I made the points here on the basis of the outline that, without just reading out the book that I wanted to talk about today, in the small called articles, you have primary principle the same emphases. First of all, that this is a contempt for God and its egocentricity, and it's total. It's total. Huh? An interesting little observation on page 308 to 28, even when you're sleeping at work sometimes. You, of course, I don't have to explain, I think, to you what that meant, but that was a nocturnal emission. It's universal, it affects all people, it is guilt. In the small called articles, in the Latin word, it's called culpa, and it is personal, and it is beyond comprehension. It is a dreadful captivity, and it results in sins, behavior to the law, contrary to the law of God, in outward deeds, and inward dispositions and thoughts. But Luther makes a point here that ought to be made: that violation of human traditions is not sin. Only sin against God's law, not against human requirements. It is beyond all enumeration. It intensifies wrath toward God. When we read the law, and even Paul says that the law worketh wrath. When we study the law and really understand what it's saying, and the more fully we understand its requirements, the more deeply we resent God. That's all the law can ever generate in us. And the knowledge of sin is, the source of it is, of course, the Holy Scriptures, which produces contrition created in you by God. It's not something that you generate yourself. That's why it's called passiva contritio. And we must know our sickness, like Melanchthon says in the Apology, before we appreciate God's cure.